Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's go to something useful for everybody, and you probably have heard of the old maximum heart rate formula. Your heart rate for your best heart rate for exercise. I was trained on the 220 minus the age is your maximum heart rate. And then your aerobic exercise is about 70% of your maximum heart rate. So you, in order to build aerobic fitness, you go to 70% of the maximum. And the sort of above 70%, you're going, getting into the fat burning and muscle building area. So that's from 1971. And when you look back critically at that paper, it kind of stinks. The original study combined data from several different sources, and it didn't have criteria about who the subjects were or what the exercise protocols were. And the formula was kind of fitted by eye. Now, they didn't use any proper statistical model to come up with that formula. So it's become exercise science orthodoxy, and yes, indeed, taught in medical schools and all of that. But newer research suggests that, well, once you apply rigorous statistics, the age-related decrease in maximum heart rate is much slower than the original formula implies. One commonly cited alternative is the Tanaka equation. So get out your phones or your pencil. We're going to do some, we're going to do a calculation. I want you to take 208, and subtract your age, and then multiply that by 0.7. And that is your theoretical maximum heart rate. It's closer to the amount, but this is, you know, again, medicine for the average. So that's the center line of the bell curve. And in this case, the bell curve is not narrow, it's broad. So certain individuals that will be way above overestimating their maximum heart rate that they're capable of achieving, and I'll explain how that mechanism works in a second. For others, it will be well below their maximum heart rate and will be kind of an easy heart rate. I'm one in that group where I'm like, well, I'm not wiped out enough to be exercising at my maximum heart rate. So I must be an outlier, and I probably am in that direction. With respect to a different study published in Public Library of Science in October of 2025, it used seven different formulas. Then they did seven different formulas on 230 people. And of course, these were individuals. They had all seven different numbers. And they found that individual predictions were off by as much as 20 beats per minute in either direction, meaning that what would be moderate exercise for one 50-year-old could be vigorous exercise for another. So what should you do to keep yourself safe and in your training? Pick one method and stick to it and just look for improvement. What's improvement look like? Well, improvement looks like you can go further and faster with a lower heart rate. And if you'll know if your training method is working, if that's headed in the right direction. So it's not so much about a number, it's about the delta or the trend line. And that, I think, is an important insight. I have some good news about tuna. I've been very worried about mercury in the large predator fish. I am a boomer, and as a result, I had many amalgams in my mouth with mercury. And I am a little haunted by a study that was done 20 or 30 years ago in a morgue. I think it was in Boston. It was one of the big West Coast cities, East Coast cities. They basically had people who were killed in traffic accidents. That's it. You were, you know, killed on the road, totally random death. And they were have to do a autopsy on those people. So the study was they looked in the mouth and they counted how many silver fillings the individual had. And then they did a biopsy of the butt fat in the gluteus, and they looked for how much mercury was there. And what they found was a linear correlation, essentially, the more fillings, the higher the butt fat, which is certainly fairly direct evidence suggesting that some of the quote-unquote inert, inorganic mercury that is in those fillings manage to find its way into the body fat of the individual. And we're not worried about the effects of mercury in your butt fat, but we are worried about the effects of mercury in your nerves. And the fact is that it has a profound effect on the structure of the nerves. The mercury ions infiltrate nerve cells. They get into the fat. They get into the nerve cell. They cause microtubule disassembly that affects the structure. It's like melting the scaffolding in a building. And so the nerve, it deteriorates, loses function, strong correlation with peripheral neuropathy and mercury levels. And I haven't seen a study looking at directly at fillings and peripheral neuropathy, but it's water under the bridge, right? Because the dentists have stopped using mercury amalgam, just kind of backed away slowly. We're not admitting there's a problem. We're just look over here. Let's use this instead. It's prettier. It's white. So, tuna is a large predatory fish, and it eats smaller fish, which eat smaller fish, which eat smaller fish. And so at each level, the smaller organisms absorb mercury, and then it just concentrates, and the large fish live longer, and so they can absorb a lot of mercury. But a recent assessment came out in Consumer Labs that looked at tuna products and found three with remarkably favorable toxicological profiles. Now, I want to state, I don't love Consumer Lab because it's a pay-for-play organization. If you want to be evaluated by Consumer Lab, you have to essentially pay them a fee, and then they ostensibly, they basically analyze those who are in the cohort that they're testing. You have to have confidence in your product to submit it to Consumer Lab, and I suppose, you know, if you think that through, you wouldn't want to pay your money, submit it, and then have it come up snake eyes really bad with a lot of mercury. So you're standing by your product just to put it to this test. So to be, you know, just thinking about it, I'm inclined to go with these products. There's a company called Safe Catch, and they had in two of their tunas, they had no detectable levels of mercury. The Wild Elite Pure Tuna and the Wild Ahi Yellowfin Tuna. And I think I've seen those at our local Costco. So you know Costco. You see it on Thursday. It might not be there for another 2 months or ever again. They're not terribly consistent in a lot of the products. And so I think tuna is an excellent food source. It's high in omega-3 fatty acids. And if we can be getting tuna that does not have mercury in it, I will go back to eating tuna. I would particularly like some ahi. Thank you very much. Loved that ahi sushi, but haven't had it in years. I was trained that we should tell people that if they were trying to conceive, the man should refrain from ejaculation for at least 2 to 7 days prior to providing sperm for his fertility test, or more pertinently, for in vitro fertilization. And these guidelines were based on maximizing sperm count. Well, it turns out quality is more important than quantity. A meta-analysis of 115 studies involving nearly 55,000 men found that the longer sperm stays in the body, the more it deteriorates. Older sperm show increased DNA damage, poorer motility, and cell damage from free radicals. This pattern held true across 30 non-human species as well. A separate clinical trial of 453 couples suggests that the distinction really matters. The IVF pregnancy rate was 46% when men abstained for less than 48 hours, compared with just 36% for those who followed the longer window. For couples trying naturally, a balance must be struck between quantity and quality. But a long abstinence very definitely is not supported by the science as being the best strategy here for your fertility. I have one more good news story that I'm going to throw out there. This hit the headlines this week. Pancreatic cancer, a new mRNA vaccine for pancreatic cancer, has shown great promise. Pancreatic cancer kills over 87% of patients within 5 years. Now there's a personalized mRNA vaccine that shows strikingly early promise. We're talking 7 out of 8 people who got this survived. It's just been announced, obviously, with these sorts of therapies. It was developed a while back. It takes a while before you're willing to say that it's working. In this, 16 patients with early stage pancreatic cancer received a vaccine that was custom built. Basically, they had an operable tumor, so they had their tumor removed surgically, and then the genetic material from their own tumors was used to train the immune system to hunt down and destroy any lingering cancer cells before they could cause a recurrence. Only half the patients responded in the study, but that was 8, and they produced the specialized killer T cells that target tumor cells. And as I said, 6 years later, 7 of those 8 are still alive. Researchers think that the vaccine generates helper T cells that help sustain the immune response over time. This is one of the most difficult cancers to treat, partly because it builds a wall around itself, a kind of thick matrix like a thorn bush all the way around the actual tumor, and the immune system can't get inside this barrier. It doesn't circulate, that they can't get in there. And so finding a way to put holes in that has been the focus of a lot of therapy. We can just get our agents past the wall into the fortress, so to speak. We can kill the cancer. But in this case, remember, these are for people whose wall has been removed. Their whole physical cancer is gone. And any single cells that are floating around that escaped, and they're in the bloodstream, they're hiding in the bone marrow, they're hiding in the brain, they haven't had a chance to build that barrier that is the hallmark of pancreatic cancer. So this will work well for people whose cancers are found early. And that's one of the areas where we start thinking about these cancer DNA tests and whether it makes sense if there's a strong history of pancreatic cancer in the family, for example. Do we want to encourage those individuals to test annually? The cost is, you know, considerable. It's over $1,000 for most of these tests, and that's going to repeat every year. But if it allows us to find the cancer early because suddenly the person's testing positive for cancer biological breakdown products or cancer cell metabolites that aren't normally found in the body, since we can test for those, we can then use our advanced imaging techniques and probably find these early operable tumors. So very good news and very impressive news as far as I'm concerned. Another vaccine that is poised for release is a Lyme disease vaccine. This new Lyme disease vaccine doesn't have a trade name yet, but Pfizer and its partner Valneva have produced studies. In one trial, 9,400 people, ages 5 and up, 4 doses of the shot reduced Lyme infection by more than 70%. This would have been in an area that was full of Lyme and full of children. This is a vaccine that has to work for free-range children if it's really going to make a dent in this disease. The results look promising. The study has not yet been peer-reviewed. It was announced, but the company say they are confident enough to submit the data to regulators. Lyme disease, as you may know, is spread through bites from infected blackleg ticks. Nearly 500,000 Americans get Lyme each year, and sometimes, often, it's missed, particularly if a person catches it during a flu epidemic, because the symptoms are, the initial symptoms are pretty identical to just a bad viral infection. And while there is a characteristic rash in the aftermath of this initial disease, a lot of the people, their rash occurs in a part of their body that nobody's looking at, or the rash is minimal or otherwise not noticed. And chronic Lyme can cause damage to the nervous system, the brain, the immune system. It can lead to a chronic fatigue syndrome. I mean, these are real things. It also can cause rheumatologic symptoms like joint pain. And it's not a disease you want to get if you can avoid it. So having a way, particularly to vaccinate children in areas where there's a high prevalence of these ticks, and the ticks actually are testing positive for Lyme disease, this is a big step forward. I'm hoping that it pans out. Another one bites the dust is my attitude about viral infections and bacterial infections. This one is a bacteria. So now we're going to move into a sort of esoteric area. I'll start off by saying that the Secretary of Health and Human Services has said shortly after his appointment in 2024 that America's drug regulators' war on public health is about to end, promising to halt the organization's aggressive suppression of all sorts of alternative medicines. And he particularly mentioned peptides. And so we're going to wander around a little bit in the Alice in Wonderland world of peptides. So let's first of all talk about what a peptide is. Basically, a peptide is just a biological molecule that's made of amino acids, but it's too small to count as a full-blown protein, but it's made of the same stuff. It seems kind of a little bit of a quibble, doesn't it? But you're going to be familiar with a very common peptide, insulin, that regulates blood sugar, and it's a small molecule. Other drugs for weight loss, like semaglutide and tirzepatide, are GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1 analogs, and peptides have become a kind of catch-all for a whole constellation of unlicensed drugs, some of which aren't even peptides, but they're promising you the moon, a little bit of the kickapoo snake oil, if you ask me, in terms of the promises, but not regulated. The most committed users of peptides have built a folk pharmacology around them, a sort of amateur medical ecosystem in which they try to hack their own biology on the basis of animal studies, informed speculation, and crossed fingers. Self-hacked is one of the most venerable and long-lived, I guess it's a blog, and lots of people have responded to that. I've actually, on searches, found myself reading through some of what they have to say, and they're reading the literature, okay? Let's give them credit. They're extrapolating from it, and there are forums that are full of self-taught researchers that discuss the latest studies and think about dosing schedules and argue about drug combinations. And they see themselves as short-circuiting a medical system that they see as overly slow and overly cautious, and which is organized around curing diseases rather than optimizing well-being. And, of course, we have Joe Rogan, who is the world's most popular podcaster. He's a fan. We'll come to the bodybuilder cohort in a moment. But on February 27th, on Mr. Rogan's podcast, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced his intention to allow 14 peptides to be prepared by licensed compounding pharmacies in the United States on prescription. Last month, one of my patients came in and asked me if I would prescribe or what I thought about prescribing a peptide that is purported to improve sexual desire. I looked it up. It's actually supposed to be for perimenopausal women. This person is well past menopause, but certainly also has an interest in maintaining an active sex life. So what's the harm? Well, that's the problem. A century ago, it was legal. Athletes could use mixtures of strychnine, heroin, cocaine, and caffeine to improve their performance. By the 1950s, it was the age of hormones, and testosterone and its synthetic alternatives started to rise, first in weightlifting, then in gyms, then across professional sports, as we all know those stories. The East German swim team to the Barry Bonds, all of it around the use of steroids. Peptides are generally legal to sell in many rich countries, as a loophole allows them to be put on sale for as long as they are marked as not for human use. The websites that offer them go out of their way to refer to them as research chemicals and tell customers they should not be taking the stuff themselves. But, wink, wink, nod, nod, some of the same sites sell sterilized water as well as syringes. But, yeah, this is for your cat. Some even provide helpful video instructions on exactly how to administer the compounds they send out, but that's not the same as advocating their use. And they're much cheaper than drugs when they're sold in this way. So 5 milligrams of Mounjaro, a weight loss drug made by Eli Lilly, costs about $255 in England, costs more than three times that much here, but God bless America. One online peptide seller says it will send 20 milligrams to you, four times as much, for about the equivalent of $100. There are a lot of peptides out there. A compound that is selling very well is retatrutide. It's a weight loss drug that's actually made by Eli Lilly. The drug is still in clinical trials. It's not been approved for sale by any medical regulator, but it's an easy molecule to make. And firms and individuals are offering to sell this product. There's lots of websites that will actually sell it to you. And there's a secondary market now coming out of companies that offer medical and testing services and specialize in treating those who use these performance-enhancing drugs. And this is an online marketplace that is just undergoing a mushroom explosion. You know how it is out in January after a rain, you walk out and suddenly that pile of leaves in your backyard is just blossoming with little white mushrooms. And you think, I wonder if those are edible. And then you say, no, let's not try it. I hope. Now, the blockbuster success of GLP-1 drugs, a triumph, I will say, for conventional medicine, has helped normalize buying drugs from questionable sources. 28% to 50% of people who use GLP-1 drugs have bought them from unlicensed websites or sellers on social media at least once. And this unnerves me. One issue is, with no official oversight, there's no guarantee that a peptide bought online is actually what it claims to be. In a study looking at 27 gray market peptide samples, this was carried out in Belgium, published in 2018. Yeah, this stuff has been going on for a while. They found purity levels ranging from 5% to 99.9%. Six vials contained more arsenic than the legal maximum, including one with levels far higher than permitted, as did one for lead. A concierge doctor firm, Private Medical, has a doctor, Jordan Schlein. He reported to the author of this article that one patient asked him to check a vial of L-carnitine. This is a small molecule, just 2 amino acids long. The patient was feeling pressured to take it. Dr. Schlein sent the bottle for testing and found it contained multiple unidentified components, including 2 synthetic stimulants with ecstasy-like properties, an agricultural weed killer, and an industrial chemical. Now, it probably didn't have really high amounts of these things, but it shows how bad the hygienic conditions in the lab, I'll put that in quotes, of the people manufacturing it is. If you're going to make something and sell it, you want to be sure that you're making what you say you're making and selling what you say you're making. That's basic ethics, in case that was not obvious. Most gray market peptides lack approval, and they don't have a lot of rigorous evidence around efficacy. They also may have unintended consequences. There's a peptide called ipramorelin. It's a peptide that's supposed to boost the body's secretion of human growth hormone. Longevity labs injecting people with human growth hormone go back 25, 30 years at least. And human growth hormone will cause increase in muscle mass. It'll make your skin look and feel younger. So it looks like it's having a rejuvenating effect. Unfortunately, most of the rejuvenation is occurring externally. Side effects include elevated risk of developing some cancers, a condition called acromegaly, in which the bones of the face and hands grow large, and diabetes, and carpal tunnel syndrome, which is a known side effect of this agent. There's an agent called BPC-157. Enthusiasts claim there are biologically plausible reasons to think it can boost the body's repair mechanisms. Yes, but there are also biologically plausible reasons to wonder if it might also increase the growth of existing cancerous tumors. The drug seems to encourage angiogenesis, the creation of new blood vessels, and that's great when you're trying to heal a wound or heal up after a surgery, but it also, if there is a tumor, which tumors rely on a blood supply to grow, and in fact, one of our main cancer-fighting drugs is a drug that suppresses angiogenesis, the development of new blood vessels. Without some really good long-term trials, this thing might be a pro-cancer agent, and yet you can buy it, well, on the web. Finally, regulatory interest is cracking down. In August of 2025, Health Canada seized a cornucopia of drugs sold by the firm Canada Peptide. The EU, in September of 25, issued a public warning of impurities, toxicities, dangerous interactions with other medications, and it's trying to promote cross-border collaboration with enforcement officers and the blocking of websites. But the EU is still, you know, those countries are strongly nationalistic, and there's a lot of balkanization between them. It would sort of be like people in Arizona refusing to accept rice made in California, requiring, you know, increased amounts of testing. We just don't have that problem here. The lines that separate Arizona from California don't have the kind of historical, I guess I would say, magic that the lines that separate Germany and Austria do. Anyway, RFK Jr. is going to halt aggressive suppression and allow these things to be available. At least he's going to license them and make it so that you can get them with a prescription from a compounding pharmacy, but crack down on the cowboys out there on the internet. If you have a safe source available for this and a willingness to take risk for whatever goals that you are taking it for, that's an informed decision. And I don't have a problem with informed decisions, although there are certainly problems with using these peptides. They also can probably provide a substantial benefit in the cases of certain situations. So I try to take a more nuanced view of this controversy. The main thing I'm concerned about is toxicity and purity. And I think those are non-negotiable when you're injecting something into your body. Let's move on to a discussion of spring cleaning for the brain. It's really amazing what happens when you log off of social media. Put down your phone for 2 weeks, and you could reverse a decade's worth of cognitive decline. Well, not really, but that's the finding of one of the largest studies of its kind. It was 450 people, and for 14 days, the participants used an app called Freedom to block internet access on their phones. Their calls and texts were still allowed. Their daily time online plummeted from more than 5 hours to just over 2.5. And by the end of the period, participants showed marked improvement in sustained attention, mental health, and well-being. The gain in attention was equivalent to about 10 years of age-related decline, and the effect on depression symptoms was comparable to that of a series of cognitive behavioral therapy sessions. Encouragingly, even those who cheated by borrowing a phone still benefited, and many reported that the positive effects lingered well after the experiment finished. Findings echo those of a separate Harvard study, which found that just a week of reduced smartphone use produced drops in anxiety, depression, and insomnia. Phone use is far more damaging than computer use, the researchers say, because it tends to be compulsive and mindless. People scroll while walking, eating, and talking, making those activities less satisfying and relationships less fulfilling. You don't have to restrict yourself forever, says co-author Kostadin Kushlev from Georgetown University. Even a partial detox, even for a few days, seems to work. So what about taking a weekend day off? You'll have to read a book or a newspaper or a magazine. You're allowed to watch television. It's not no screens. It's just no social media. And I guess basically no shopping and web searches. No Pinterest? Could I do it? Yeah, sure I could. I've got books. They're a superpower. So think about it. Are you spending too much time? Are you losing a half hour, 45 minutes, just, you know, scrolling through a series of random links that show up on a social media post? You can live without that. Try living without that on a regular basis, and you will thank yourself. Now, here's some disturbing news. As many as 1 in 4 patients diagnosed as being in a vegetative state may actually be conscious, trapped inside an unresponsive body, but aware and listening. This was a report in the New York Times of a study that was done across multiple countries, examining 241 patients, all of whom appeared to be unresponsive during the standard bedside exams. But when given advanced brain scans and asked to perform mental tasks, such as imagining playing tennis, a quarter of them showed brain activity, indicating they understood and could follow commands. Scientists call this cognitive motor dissociation, a disconnect between a semi-conscious mind and an immobile body. By some estimates, 50,000 Americans have been classified as in chronic vegetative state, with up to 400,000 more minimally conscious. If the study's ratio holds, tens of thousands of those people may be living in continuous care facilities, yet may be aware enough to be in pain. But testing for this type of consciousness is available only in a few clinics, and it's nowhere the standard of care. What this study shows is that bedside exams are highly unreliable. Some studies have shown that up to 40% of these vegetative state diagnoses may be wrong. It's not okay to know this and do nothing. I'm thinking about the research lab that I spent a little bit of time in for a year when I was doing my gap year between undergrad and medical school. Back then, the lot of a researcher was to sit on a hard metal stool amidst the smell of urine and the scratching of lab animals in cages. Soon, that will be giving way to the gentle bubbling sounds of aerated nutrient broth. Scientists have developed glands in a dish. We've talked about organoids before, but in this case, we're talking about the adrenal gland. They've done a lab-grown version of the adrenal cortex, the part that makes the corticosteroids, cortisol, the outer part of the adrenal gland. These regulate metabolism, stress, and blood pressure. And this is a tiny little ball that is essentially like an embryonic adrenal gland. This research came out of China. By the way, China has gone in the last decade from producing a very small percentage of the scientific research to second in the world after the United States for the number of studies. They have almost equaled the United States in terms of new drug discovery. It's easier to just call people up and say, congratulations, the party would like you to be an experimental subject in our new drug study. Please arrive at this office at this time. Can't do that here. But anyway, they're developing new drugs very quickly. But we're not talking about new drugs. We're talking about essentially organoids. And this doesn't look identical to the adrenal cortex, but the organoid was able to perform the functions. They transplanted it into mice whose adrenal glands had been removed, and it actually listened to the adrenal cortex stimulating hormone that was being produced in the pituitary gland and produced cortisol. This is, of course, a hormone involved in the stress response. In another experiment, the authors introduced a genetic mutation into the organoid that was linked to the development of a cortisol-producing tumor. This is essentially going to be an organoid model for Cushing's syndrome. This will allow us to study the disease and test drugs to inhibit the abnormal production of cortisol. Currently, we usually have to remove the tumor, and that means the person has to be on cortisol for the rest of their life. And it's problematic whether we're going to get the dose right. The lovely thing about a gland is that it can turn on a dime and produce amazing results. It can go from 0 to 60 in 10 seconds in terms of production of cortisol, something that is required when there's a bacterial infection. The body pumps out enormous amounts of cortisol, and this helps the body fight the infection. It's a anti-inflammatory, so it also helps prevent the cytokine storm. So it's a very nuanced response that we have a hard time producing on our own. So people without adrenal glands are at a much higher risk of complications from infections. Well, you've probably heard the expression, maybe you even know someone who develops hives or rashes as a result of psychological stress. It's just an observed phenomenon that psychological stress exacerbates atopic dermatitis and other inflammatory skin diseases. In fact, I wonder if what I noticed during COVID was, and it was after I got the vaccine, but I got a dermatitis. I don't get dermatitises, and I thought it was probably a vaccine side effect, but I also was under an enormous amount of stress during that epidemic, and I'm wondering if this mechanism may have also played a role. The authors of this study, which is a neuroimmunology study published in Science in March of this year, identified a population of neuroepinephrine-producing sympathetic neurons that specifically go to hairy skin and mediate stress-induced aggravation of skin inflammation using eosinophils, which are typically an allergic response. Eczema is associated with an intense itching sensation. And atopic dermatitis is the most prevalent version of this, maybe 5 to 10% of adults. It's extreme itching, redness, sometimes a little bit of flaking. And what the researchers were able to do was, using dyes, they were able to identify the nerves. They used an injectable dye, and they identified that these were sympathetic nervous system nerves, and that they were showing up, being stimulated, going to the skin. And essentially, there's a place in the brain called the stellate ganglion. Psychological stress stimulates these sympathetic neurons in the stellate ganglion in the brain, and they promote the recruitment. They go down into the skin, and they promote the recruitment of eosinophils.
Here's a fun science fact. Eosinophils are called such because they avidly gather up a dye that we use to stain cells called eosin. So they are eosinophils, or eosin lovers. We associate these cells with allergic reactions and with parasitic infections. In fact, when they're high in the bloodstream, we go looking for parasites, actually. They're closely related to IgE, although they do not make IgE, which is the antibody for allergies. Eosinophils basically make allergic inflammation worse, but the identification of a cognitive eosinophil connection is actually quite new. Eosinophils are also involved in an obscure drug reaction syndrome called DRESS, which stands for Drug Reaction with Eosinophilia and Systemic Symptoms, or DRESS syndromes. In my clinical years, I've never actually seen this syndrome, but it shows up frequently on board exams due to its obscurity and lack of application to general medical practice. An interesting side note to this story is that the researchers actually used a, quote, pseudo-rabies virus, in this case, injecting it into the skin and allowing it to climb up into the central nervous system and following the trail of its pathway to discover exactly how this sympathetic pathway to the stellate ganglion existed. I'll conclude by quoting the final paragraph of this paper. A growing body of research highlights the bidirectional communication between nervous and the immune systems. Stress, in particular, imprints fetal and adult systems with distinct inflammatory signatures that influence many aspects of immunity. These include modulation of barrier functions of the skin epithelium, such as permeability, as well as biological responses, such as the activation of mast cells or basophils. By revealing how specific stress-responsive neuronal circuits can amplify skin inflammation, Tien et al. Offer a mechanistic explanation for the well-documented but poorly understood link between stress and atopic dermatitis flare-ups. It is unclear how different types of psychological stress, acute or chronic, physical or emotional, engage the neuroimmune axis that the authors identified. Whether other immune cell types or other neuronal subtypes are involved in this process is also unknown. Research into the existence of similar mechanisms in other stress-sensitive inflammatory diseases, such as psoriasis or inflammatory bowel disease, is also needed. As you may have heard, the map is not the territory, but the map can be pretty darn useful. This previous story discussed the identification of the neurologic pathway between stress, the stellate ganglion, and the skin, showing a connection to atopic eczema. Eczema, in general, is a condition characterized by dry, itchy, and inflamed skin. It's prevalent during childhood, and many cases begin during the first year of life. It also frequently remits in early childhood. Although eczema is associated with genetic factors, such as mutations in the filigrin gene, which causes a leaky skin, so to speak, analogous to a leaky gut, and great chemical sensitivity. Environmental factors obviously playing into that, and also immune factors. Research using mice has provided experimental evidence that early childhood eczema begins in the womb. Using mouse models, the researchers showed that the offspring of stressed pregnant mothers develop eczema-like skin lesions in response to mechanical stimuli that are normally harmless, such as gentle scratching. Although studies in humans have pointed to links between maternal stress during pregnancy and the development of allergic diseases in early childhood, causality has been difficult to establish, hence this mouse study. Shurhan and researchers stressed pregnant mice by exposing them to bright light in the middle of their pregnancies. And, remarkably, offspring born to these stressed mothers showed more water loss from their skin due to changes in that permeability barrier, and also showed more signs of inflammation than control offsprings. These characteristics are indicative of skin barrier dysfunction, in contrast to allergic asthma, which is common in adults, completely different ballgame. Researchers found that type 2 inflammation was not involved in at a systemic levels. Instead, early life eczema often manifests as parts of the body that flex, such as the elbows, and might be triggered by mechanical friction. So to investigate the idea that the sensory neurons in the skin are upregulated through an induction by prenatal stress, they used a technique called transcriptomic analysis to look at the gene expression in the dorsal root ganglia, where the cell bodies of the sensory neurons live. In offspring exposed to prenatal stress, there was an upregulation of the genes associated with the mechanoreceptor neurons. So that makes a great deal of sense. The volume, or the gain, if you will, is turned up in the spinal column in the cells that extend tendrils out to the skin. And that is what's triggering early childhood eczema. They also looked at mast cells, which can be thought of as the end effector cells in allergic reactions. What they found there was rather fascinating. Stress during pregnancy in the mother mice led to increased levels of cortisone in the amniotic fluid surrounding the fetus. The skin of the fetus is colonized by immune cells called mast cells, which are derived from the yolk sac. This is a small structure outside of the embryo. The exposure of these mast cells to corticosterone induces transcriptional changes that lead to increased or more easily activated mast cells. So in the weeks after birth, the offspring who were exposed to prenatal stress do develop these eczema-like skin lesions. They have inflammation and thickening of the epidermal layer, and areas that are affected are those that receive mechanical stimulation a little bit more commonly than the rest of the body. For example, in a fold of an elbow or a knee where the skin rubs against itself. That's increased mechanical stimulation. Ordinarily shouldn't cause this reaction, but because the mast cells are activated by that amniotic corticosterone, they do. By about 24 weeks after birth, and that's in mice, so we're talking about probably multiply by about 10 for humans, the activated mast cells are replaced by mast cells coming from the bone marrow. Those are not activated, and so the early life eczema disappears. Just more evidence that everything's connected.
Let's see, we have maybe got a caller. Hello, this is Dr. Don, you're on the air.
Are there any side effects to CBN?
CBN is a compound that is one of the cannabinoids. And, of course, we know CBD and CBN is one that's been getting more attention lately. This class of agents is calming, and it takes most of its action, as I understand it, in affecting the breakdown of anandamide, anandamide being our own natural cannabinoid, and it's made and excreted by cells in our nervous system and has a calming effect, but it's also broken down very quickly, and it's somewhat euphoric. It's a lovely feeling to take it. It's a lovely feeling to make it, and it's too short. So what the cannabinoids, these other cannabinoids do is prolong the effect, slow the breakdown. And that's my understanding. I think in terms of side effects, that is going to depend on the dose. And I'm really worried about doses that are higher than that that can be achieved without, you know, substantial modification of the extraction process from the marijuana. So people are taking this and concentrating it at levels that would never be found in nature. And so far, we haven't identified much in the way of side effects. But as I say, I think keeping the doses low and not, you know, don't play the let me take you higher game that is being played all over the place, because we have gotten to the point where we have turned THC into something that's actively have withdrawal symptoms from, which are physiological. It's tentatively okay at low doses, but I wouldn't go mega dosing it. I hope that helps. And it is, of course, a bit of a waffle, because in 5 years we'll know more. If we ever get the regulatory system set up so that we can actually do good science on the cannabinoids, that would be wonderful. But right now, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen in the United States Congress and Senate and regulatory bodies? It's anybody's guess. Real Wild West out there. So we have another call coming in. Hello, are you there?
Yes, this is Pat in Santa Cruz. Yes, what do you consider a low dose?
Well, okay, 25 milligrams of CBD or CBN, or a combination of the two, I consider a low dose. 150,
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, what I have is, what is it, 15 milligram things, and I take two of them. I like two of CBN at bedtime. And then sometimes if I wake up during the night, I might take one more, just to, you know, because I don't always go back to sleep easily. And I'm just wondering if that's too much, if I should cut back.
Well,
I
mean, what's the aggregate dose there if you add up all the milligrams?
For the whole night, it would be, you know, what is it, 45 milligrams?
You know, over an eight-hour period, I don't think that's a problem, just based on seat-of-the-pants clinical experience.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
But I worry, as I said to the previous caller, I worry about the concentrations and getting things stronger and stronger, which seems to be kind of, you know, bigger is better, stronger is better. That's sort of I don't think that's a good mentality when we're talking about drugs, whether they're naturally derived or chemically derived.
Right. Of course. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening, Pat.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.